Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, it's the Week in Review. We'll talk more about sexual harassment allegations, controversy with the state police altering reports, and Governor Charlie Baker's push to combat the opioid addiction crisis. Also today, just how big is the diversity gap in Massachusetts tech? One report finds that it could take 70 years for African Americans to catch up to white men in the industry.
The talent is distributed evenly in populations, but the opportunities aren't. We need to make sure that every kid has the opportunity to participate. This is an economy that pays twice the state average.
Plus, Massachusetts and Hydro-Quebec.
We are incredibly well poised to deliver what Massachusetts is requiring, and that's clean hydroelectric energy from Canada that economically will benefit all of New England.
But it comes at a cost for Native Canadians and some New Hampshire residents. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday. Time for the Week in Review, and we'll begin with continued allegations of sexual abuse and harassment locally and nationally. The latest against Senator Al Franken, that from radio host Leanne Tweeden.
And he comes up and he grabs me and he puts his hand behind my head and he aggressively comes in and he mashes his mouth up against mine and he sticks his tongue in my mouth. I was violated. I was disgusted. That's not what I was expecting.
And Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore says he is not backing down despite numerous reports.
I'm now facing allegations, and that's all the press want to talk about. But I want to talk about the issues. I want to talk about where this country's going. And if we don't come back to God, we're not going anywhere.
And locally, gymnast and Olympian Allie Raceman of Needham is speaking out about abuse by the USA Gymnastics team doctor.
I'm not going to stop until I get what I want, which is change. And I don't want the current generation and the next generation of athletes or, you know, kids around the world to ever have to go through this again.
And the Berklee College of Music president this week says the school has fired some 11 faculty members for sexual misconduct over the past 13 years. Here's senior Georgetta Sesserman.
I wish that they took responsibility for the way that they were handling these cases. This is the safety of our students. This is the safety of us and our survivors and the way that we heal.
So joining us now to discuss is Reverend Mariama White-Hammond. She's a minister of the Bethel AME Church in Jamaica Plain, also an activist and organizer. Reverend White-Hammond, it's good to see you again.
Great to be here.
Also with us, Joe Battenfeld, Boston Herald political columnist and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Joe, it's good to have you back as
Thanks, great to be here.
So let me just start with the basic question. I mean, we played all of those clips because those were all from this week, and that's just scratching the surface. Just the volume of the allegations and the reports and the people coming forward seems overwhelming, Reverend White-Hammond. What do you make of that?
I mean, I'm not surprised. I think if I got a group of my friends in a room and started trading stories, I mean, we'd be up all night. Everybody, as a woman, I don't know any woman that hasn't experienced sexual harassment. Some people are in jobs where they experience it weekly. Some of us are in jobs where we're a little bit more surprised. I mean, even as a minister, wearing my collar, I've had men come on to me inappropriately. So if you are not worried that God's going to strike you for being inappropriate with a minister, I mean, you can imagine that folks, you know. So I think, unfortunately, sexual harassment is just been such a part of our society. What's exciting to me is we're finally calling it out and we're finally saying it's not acceptable. I don't know exactly why this was the moment of tipping point, but I'm glad it's come.
So has this happened to you too?
I'm not joking. I have literally had people say, oh, are you a minister? And I say, yeah. And then they go, oh, I didn't know there were ministers that look like that. And you're like, really? Is that the first thing that came to your mind? So, I mean, any woman who spends time walking down the street, Unfortunately, this is far too commonplace. But I'm glad we're finally talking about it and doing something.
Joe, your thoughts?
I certainly have heard a lot of stories about this over the years. I worked in politics a lot. I worked down in Washington. The stories I heard were pretty frightening from women. It's rampant down there among elected officials, among staff members. It's way too common. I've heard stories about it, and I'm glad it's coming to the forefront now. And I know at the State House, other places, they're working to put in official policies now against harassment. You shouldn't need a policy against harassment. There needs to be more than just a change in these policies. There's got to be really a change in attitude, I think. And I think it's all these allegations coming forward, all these reports coming forward, I think is pushing this issue forward and forcing men to deal with it. And I think it's good that people are getting called out on it.
Yeah. So what's interesting to me is that people absolutely are getting called out. This is not a problem that belongs to only one side of the aisle or another.
Oh yeah.
But I mean, along those, I say that because I also wanted to just read a tweet from the president on the Al Franken issue. President Trump tweeted that the Al Frankenstein picture is really, really bad, speaks 1,000 words. Where do his hands go in picture 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 while she sleeps? And of course, I mean, we remind ourselves that President Trump is on the record during the campaign of like admitting that he grabs women against their will.
Yeah.
But that doesn't, he's still in the White House.
Well, I'm surprised. I didn't even think about that. There might be other pictures, but, you know, I think there's a possibility that the president can imagine because maybe he's done something similar. I mean, maybe, you know, so I mean, when you openly talk about groping people, you know, that's really concerning.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm glad that Al Franken has come out and admitted it. I think the truth is, and I think this is where it gets hard, is that a lot of behaviors that we consider being quote-unquote manly or that we dismiss as being, you know, guys being guys are sexual harassment. And so I think that this question of not just getting people to talk about specific incidents, but to talk about the culture that makes people think that these things are either okay. And sometimes I've seen people blatantly sexually harassing people and other people are laughing about it. So it's not even just that things are happening in silence or in secret places. I've seen it happen openly in the public, and nobody steps in.
So, Joe, let me get your take on the Roy Moore situation in Alabama, because there we have the opposite, right? He's doubling down.
He is doubling down, and basically he's pulling a Donald Trump here is what he's doing. He's basically saying the Washington establishment is against me. The Washington Post, Mitch McConnell, they're all against me. And it's certainly worked for Trump. And I wouldn't be surprised at all. I know this is hard to believe. I would not be surprised at all if Roy Moore won.
Right.
Because there's certainly a feeling if he turns this into the Washington politicians are against me instead of the actual allegations that are against him, I think that works in his favor. And I mean, I know the polls show him, I think, trailing a little bit, but I wouldn't trust polls on this one. It's a strategy that he's using.
Yeah, I mean, to me, this really does just sort of lay bare my cynicism that I feel sometimes about politics, because both in the 2016 election and with the Roy Moore situation, I feel like we're seeing how in America right now, we are in a place where at times politics and political allegiances can trump Trump can come before decency, right? Because I mean, here we have Roy Moore, who this week his lawyer came out and said he wanted to see the yearbook, this photo of the yearbook, saying that maybe his signature in the yearbook was fraudulent, so throwing conspiracy theory into there.
Right.
Whereas we have a number of people who are making serious allegations against him. There's the stories about him being banned from the local mall because of his behavior. I mean, lots and lots and lots of stuff. And yet I agree with you. I think that the polling coming out of Alabama right now, I'm not sure if we can entirely trust it, because people may not want to tell pollsters they still are going to vote for Moore.
I agree. I wouldn't trust the polls on this right now. Exactly what you said. They may not be willing to tell pollsters they're voting for Moore. And certainly the stories, the reports against him are horrifying, to say the least, if even a partial portion of that is true. But it is going to be something the voters have to decide, I think. If they try to expel him, if he is elected, it's very interested what to see what will happen. What's going to happen if they try to expel him? Mm-hmm. Are they going to try to, do they have to try to expel Al Franken too if they do that? So it opens up all kinds of questions, and I think the, you know, unfortunately, it is going to have to come to the voters, and he's not going anywhere.
Yeah. So, Reverend White Hammond, I have a question for you about the Roy Moore situation.
Yeah.
Because, you know, one thing that some of his supporters were saying over the course of this week and last week was, you know, one of the women accusing him of sexual assault really was 14 at the time. Mm-hmm. And we were seeing
Mary.
We were seeing people say, well, maybe it's okay because Mary was a teenager when she became mother to Jesus. I mean,
I don't know if people are being, I have a hard time believing that people are very serious in that they really spent time praying about that, and that is something God revealed to them. I mean, I think the reality is, as you mentioned, unfortunately, and this happens on all sides, we say we believe in something, and sometimes we put partisan politics and other agendas ahead of common sense, our basic values. So, you know, I do think this is a reckoning as a person of faith, and particularly as a Christian. It is disturbing to me how many Christians are supporting him anyway. He's using this whole idea that he's under attack and it's demonic forces. And I'm like, it's the demonic forces that had you putting your hands on children. That is the evil. And that either, if you can't admit that and start from there, but unfortunately, people of faith are not exempt from being hypocritical. Mm. And I think, unfortunately, too many Christian leaders in Alabama are, you know, that's what I would say is going on right now.
So, you know, in the spirit of journalistic integrity and full transparency, I also want to mention that NPR this week had ongoing issues with allegations of harassment and hostile work culture there at NPR. NPR's own media correspondent David Folkenflik has been reporting that on Wednesday, the chairman of NPR's board announced that he was stepping down. And according to a source, the board chair is the subject of a complaint filed with NPR. Another senior editor has been put on leave right now as NPR has to investigate allegations against him as well. Many female and women reporters and editors and producers at NPR beginning to come forward saying that the work environment there has been extraordinarily difficult for them. So, you know, it seems like there isn't a single institution that hasn't been touched by this yet. But I actually wanted to read something very briefly to both of you and get your thoughts on this right now, because everyone's talking about different allegations that range from being made to feel uncomfortable, which is a thing, but made to feel uncomfortable, to assault, right? But we're having a conversation about all of it now, day in and day out. And there was a really interesting article in the Daily Beast this week from author Gloria Ryan. And she wrote this graph that I just want to read to both of you. She said, right now, the court of public opinion is faced with the awkward task of assigning degrees of severity to sexual misconduct because while they all cause harm, they don't all cause the same amount of harm and thus don't merit the same punishment. Are we talking about that enough, or is the fervor so high right now that everything seems bad?
I don't think we are talking enough about it. I agree with that everything's been lumped into sort of the same category here. What George Bush did is being lumped into what Roy Moore did, and they are not the same. Mm-hmm. And some people are obviously... If anybody did anything like this, they deserve scrutiny on this, no matter what degree it is. But I agree that we are, that they're in the fervor to report all these stories. You see all the pictures, even on TV, of all these people being accused, and they all did very different things.
Mm. Right. No, I completely agree. I mean, I think the reality is, again, I'm not dismissing any of the claims against anybody, but we've had a culture of acceptance for a long time. Mm.
The whole spectrum of behaviors.
It's not like this changed overnight. Our conversation is evolving. Our conversation is opening up, and we're talking about it more publicly. And there are some places where people have caused so much harm that they need to be held accountable. And there are other instances where, there has been harm, but what we ultimately need to do is talk about it and make sure it doesn't happen again. And finding where that line is going to be a bit of a challenge.
Yeah.
And I think we need to make sure that we're not doing it in a partisan way, because the reality is, my guess is, many more men than are being accused have done this.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done it because they watched their fathers do it, and they watched their grandfathers do it, and they got rewarded for it on the playground and have continued that. So this is a reality. And even, you know, women, there are ways in which we are being inappropriate and treating each other wrong. And now we need to figure out what is the right way to behave, start teaching that,
yeah,
start holding people accountable for it. And I think there will also be some need for forgiveness for some folks. And we need to figure out where that line of punishment forgiveness mm-hmm. is. But I hope the bigger thing is that we as a society stop accepting some of these behaviors, because
yeah,
it is a slippery slope.
Yeah. Well, I'm sad to say that I think we're probably going to talk about it again next week, since this is not going away anytime soon.
Yeah.
So let's turn now to another major piece of news from this week, and this right here in Massachusetts, because it has to do with the Massachusetts State Police, as the two top officials there are out after a federal lawsuit by two troopers who alleged that they were ordered to alter a police report to remove embarrassing information about the daughter of a judge. So we've got some tape here. This is from Wednesday. And the new state police superintendent, Colonel Kerry Gilpin, was sworn in by Governor Baker, replacing Colonel Richard McCune. Here's Governor Baker.
Look, the colonel made very clear that he initiated this. We also made very clear we thought it was a mistake. We also made very clear that the state police needs to clean up and make more explicit its policies and protocols associated with editing arrest reports. And so we believe those observation reports should be removed from those two troopers' files.
And yesterday, Congressman Stephen Lynch told Boston Herald Radio that he thinks incidents like this undermine the public's faith in law enforcement.
It should be intolerable, unacceptable. You know, I think for law enforcement to be asked by a superior, whether a civilian or otherwise, to alter what they know to be the truth is unconscionable.
Especially when it's to protect the reputation of a judge. I mean, Joe Battenfeld, what is going on?
Yeah,
here?
I've covered this story, and Governor Baker, you could hear it in his voice, sounds very defensive to me. He bungled this. He came out right away and did a very quick, I don't even know if it was an investigation, what it was exactly. You could hear it. He said, we determined that the colonel made clear that he initiated it. It's like, well, okay, let's believe the colonel. Then I guess we can stop the investigation because the colonel said he initiated it. I mean, he would not do a full investigation. And it wasn't until yesterday that the new state police colonel announced she was going to launch an investigation. And that's what should have happened at the beginning. This is not a routine, as Baker also suggested. This was kind of routine, like they change police reports all the time. This was not routine.
That would be just as bad if it were true. Right?
From what I understand, they may change like grammar and things like that. And the arrest report had already been submitted to court, mm-hmm. so they took it away from court and changed it. That may be illegal. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But there's certainly a lot of questions that have to be answered here, no matter if Governor Baker wants to answer them or not.
Now, I understand that police unions are criticizing the governor's handling of this.
Yes, they are. They for exactly that reason, that there was not a full investigation launched. They filed a complaint demanding a internal review by internal affairs and police. And what you really need is an independent investigation.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if the police colonel can do an independent investigation. Someone needs to do an independent investigation.
Mariama, what are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I actually feel a few ways. One, no, nothing should be done for one person because of their the stature of their family that's not done for someone else. Now, here's what actually I think we haven't talked about at all. What the they were asking to be removed were statements that she made that were highly problematic.
This is the daughter of the judge.
The
young woman who had been arrested.
That were inappropriate. And the reasoning was that those statements had nothing to do with her crime, which was driving under the influence, right? I actually am not necessarily against that. I want to have a deeper conversation about it. If you've clarified what the person did wrong, do you need to add other things that make them look worse. Now, I just, if we're going to be about grace, and generally I have to advocate for that, then it should be across the board.
Right.
Is that the same kind of grace that is extended to other people? If we want to have an overall, let's be gracious to people and not make them look worse than we need to, I'd love to see if that's going to be state police policy. But if it's not policy for everyone, then it shouldn't have been policy for her.
It's not policy for everyone right now.
Well,
they put these stuff like that in reports all the time.
I was under the assumption. I have experienced that personally with young people where I'm like, what does this have to do
exactly.
with the other things? So, but if the police want to be more gracious, let's have that conversation. But not because your daddy's a judge.
Yeah, I mean, the question is how far up the chain of command this went. The Secretary of Public Safety is a former colleague of not only the DA, but of the judge. They all work together in the Worcester County DA's office. So that raises questions right there, I think. And that's the question for Baker, how far up this is going to go.
How far up do you think it's going to go,
Joe? I don't know for predicting this, and it's going to be tough for the police to do it if it involves the public safety secretary, who Governor Baker has already exonerated, by the way. Mm. So what are they going to go back and say, oh, wait a minute, no, he actually did know about it. I'm not sure about that.
Wow. I think the story says a lot about how politics in Massachusetts still works to this day. Well, we've got just enough time in our left here to do our hubbubs. And that's hopefully the good news, a little bit good news,
yeah.
or maybe not terrible news that we should talk about this week. Reverend Y. Hammond?
Well, I noticed that there are a group of young people that are tussling with the president over climate change. As we know, unfortunately, he used his time in the climate summit to promote coal. So I'm thankful to our young people for leading the way. We'll see if the court allows them to keep their lawsuit. And they actually started the lawsuit under President Obama. And it basically says that this planet is theirs and the federal government should not stand in the way of the work that needs to be done to make sure our kids inherit a planet that's worth living in. So kudos to our young people in Washington State, and hopefully they will help us have some common sense climate change policy.
Climate change lawsuit. Joe Battenfeld?
There is an ongoing story at the State House that's sort of been percolating, which is State Rep Paul Heroux, who was just elected mayor. He is saying he's going to hold both seats, mayor and state rep.
Oh, yeah.
And this is, we talk about double standards.
Yeah.
They forced the mayor of Lawrence, former state rep, also William Lantigua, to give up his seat. And they're not doing the same thing for this guy. So why is that? They're going to have to face this. I think the speaker may not want to face it, but I think he's going to have to face this. And there's no way you should be able to hold both jobs.
No, yeah, that's definitely not okay. All right, well, I'm bringing the lighthearted fare to our hubbubs this week because it's I believe this is the 100th anniversary of the Halifax explosion, and of course in honor of Boston helping Nova Scotia following that major explosion a century ago, the Canadians send us a Christmas tree every year. And so this week, this year's gift tree has been selected and cut down, and it is from Bob and Marion Campbell. They have donated a tree that's over 42 feet high. It's a white spruce. And I think this is, I'm seeing it probably. This is the first time a tree from a privately donated tree has come from Cape Breton specifically. So they say, Bob and Marion Campbell say, we have been blessed to have a tree worthy of donation in recognition of the speedy and compassionate response by the people of Boston to the Halifax explosion. So there's a picture of the tree still on Bob and Marion's property. It looks beautiful, so I'm sure it'll look great when it's set up here in the city. So that's my hubbub for the day. Reverend Marianna White Hammond, minister of the Bethel AME Church in Jamaica Plain. It's great to see you. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Joe Battenfeld, Boston Herald political columnist and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Great to have you as well, Joe.
Thanks very much.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just how big is the diversity gap in the Massachusetts tech industry? Well, one word, enormous. Just 3% of the state's tech workforce is African American, and it could take almost 70 years for black employees to catch up to white men, even as the state's tech industry grows at its current rapid rate. Now, those staggering statistics are from a pair of reports from the Mass Technology Leadership Council out today, and they talk about growth trends and long-term challenges the tech industry faces here. So joining us to walk us through these reports is WBUR Bostonomics reporter Zanindra Enwemeka. Zanindra, it's good to see you.
Hey, Magna.
Okay, so these diversity numbers, I mean, what's really going on here?
Yeah, well, I mean, basically, like you said, the tech sector is booming, but it's just not reaching everyone.
Okay, so give us a sense as to what the demographic profile of the industry is right now.
Yeah, so according to Mass TLC, 71% of computer and mathematical workers are white, 22% are Asian, and only 3% are Hispanic or Latino, and only 3% are black.
Okay, so that's the picture right now then. But these reports said that it might take, 68 years for African Americans to catch up?
Oh, yeah. That's a little depressing, isn't it?
Yeah. And what about other folks?
Yeah. So this is looking at this baseline of participation within population. So around 5% of white men in the state work in tech. That number is 2% for women, black workers, and Latino workers in tech. So Mass TLC says that for women, it will take until 2070 to catch up. And for Latinos, it will take until 2045 to catch up. Yeah.
Okay. And why so long? What does the report say about that?
Yeah. So it's based on current growth rates. So really, you know, unless something changes, that's basically what the projection is. That's what we'll see. So this can partly be traced back to education and a skills gap. And much of that is really due to a lot of systemic inequality.
Right. So things like the percentage of minority young people who are choosing to go into fields, into computer science or math or things like that, that if that goes on at its current rate, it would take the 70
exactly.
years to close
the gap. Exactly, if it
goes on
at its current rate without any changes.
Okay, so we have this huge diversity gap, even as the tech sector here is growing in terms of the number of jobs. So how fast is the sector growing?
Well, it's booming. And, you know, tech represents a third of jobs in the state, according to Mass TLC. So this includes 300,000 people who work in the tech sector itself and another 100,000 who work in tech jobs in other sectors, as well as a number of support jobs in tech. So really, tech is this very strong undercurrent in the state's economy.
Wow, a third of jobs. So it's huge. Okay, so we'll come back to the diversity issue in just a minute, but give us some of the other big takeaways from these reports.
Yeah, so talent is key. It's the key part of growth in the state's tech economy. Companies love the fact that there are a lot of highly skilled workers here, so it's a big draw for companies. But there simply isn't enough talent. There's not enough of it. A good way to think about it is this. The tech sector is growing so fast that it's basically depleting the pool of talent that's here in the state. So companies are finding it challenging to fill jobs. Here's what Tom Hopcroft, the head of Mass TLC, says about that.
There are 17 openings for every graduate with a bachelor's degree in a computing and mathematical field. There are 6 for everyone with an associate's degree. There's just tremendous need to bring talented people into the industry.
Yeah, so the need is tremendous. Yeah. And Megan, if you remember, you know, when we did that big series on the future of work a couple weeks ago, we saw this. We know that this sector, many jobs in tech are projected to grow by double digits. So the need is tremendous and it's growing. And what's happening now is that companies are expanding outside the state to fill roles. The Mass TLC found that 77% of companies plan to expand outside the state in the next year. So he says there's this growing need to fill the talent pool in Massachusetts. Particularly to one that's a lot more inclusive.
Okay, so let me just kind of repeat what you said and say the obvious solution would be to grow the talent we have here from diverse communities.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. So, you know, there's this need that companies reiterate often, but we have a big population here. We have communities that aren't being reached by the tech sector that could be brought in. And that's exactly that's what Mass TLC calls for in this report, this need to really build a bigger pipeline. So they point to education, transportation, and housing, and really call for investments in all of these areas so people can be prepared for
for tech jobs, but also be able to afford to live near and easily get to those jobs. So all of these things are working together and are crucial pieces of addressing this issue. Education being a really big starting point. In the report, tech leaders point to STEM education. They say they want more STEM education. And the report also, again, talks about that skills gap and the need to train people. And Tom Hopcroft of MassTLC says really businesses, schools, and lawmakers need to collaborate on this to develop that bigger pipeline of talent. And he says these opportunities really need to start at a young age.
The talent is distributed evenly in populations, but the opportunities aren't. We need to make sure that every kid has the opportunity to participate. This is an economy that pays twice the state average. So there's an opportunity to flow capital back into a lot of different communities.
Yeah, so and that's why it's crucial to bring more people into the industry.
Okay, so here we have this pair of reports that says there's this giant diversity gap, but the needs for the tech industry are strong, and they're getting stronger than ever as time goes by. And, you know, we kind of know, we know theoretically how to solve this problem, right? So I see these things working all together, but, I mean, let me just ask you, look at your crystal ball. How does the future of tech then look in Massachusetts?
Well, the future of tech looks strong. But for, you know, as long as there is this challenge that they can't find enough people to fill these jobs, you know, that is going to be continue to be an issue. So the future looks strong, but not everyone's being reached by the tech sector. And there are populations out there that could be tapped for these jobs. And that's what the focus needs to be on.
Need to do a better job than that. Absolutely. Well, Zanindra Enwemeka covers tech and business as part of WBUR's Bostonomics team. Zanindra, thank you so very much.
Sure thing, Magna. Glad to do it.
Well, let's talk with someone who is actually actively working on making the future of tech more inclusive. Nisha McCray is the manager of the Fab Lab and the entrepreneur in residence at the Roxbury Innovation Center. She also founded Bagika, an organization that focuses on fostering ideas and those who create them through educational workshops and do-it-yourself kits for young innovators. And she joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much, Meghna. I'm glad to be here.
It's great to have you, Nisha. I mean, first of all, just tell us, what are your reactions to, especially sort of the conclusions about the diversity gap in Massachusetts tech that Zanindra just talked to us about?
Well, for me, naturally, I'm not shocked because this is pretty much my everyday existence. I'm originally from North Florida, and I actually came to Boston for more opportunity via an education at MIT. And it seems to replicate my experience in high school when I was interested in STEM, as well as my experience at MIT. And the response from other individuals through the report, I think, is what has been a little bit more shocking to me. The fact that I've had a lot of colleagues come up to me and voice their frustration that they don't understand why this report is such a big to-do, given the fact that they feel there's never going to be a point that there's just as many women or just as many Latinos or just as many African Americans or immigrants working in tech as perhaps your typical white male in that field. And so I've had to actually explain to people using Whole Foods and saying, imagine you're at a Whole Foods supermarket and you're going there to buy an apple. And you have two choices, a gala apple or a golden yellow apple. And let's say Whole Foods has a potential pool of 1,000 gala apples and a potential pool of 200 golden yellow apples. Given the report that Zinajor just mentioned, let's say gala apples represent white males in STEM. Mm-hmm. That means Whole Foods is going to put on display 50 gala apples for you to choose from. And let's say golden yellow is a minority, whether that's a woman, whether that's a black or Latino. Based on Whole Foods using the 2% statistic, they will only present to you 4 golden yellow apples.
I see.
So if you're looking to buy apples, you have the choice between 50 gala apples or 4 golden yellows. And is it possible to have 50 gala and 50 golden yellow, not given the supply? And that's why it's so important to train and move the needle ahead, and not just in 60 years.
Yeah, so that's interesting because we heard Tom Hopcroft, when I was talking to Zaninjor from MassTLC, Tom Hopcroft saying the talent is distributed evenly in populations, but the opportunities aren't. So how do we up those opportunities?
I think based on our work at Bajika, and particularly at the Roxbury Innovation Center, what I've seen work in terms of allowing people who may be disadvantaged, given their location, given their socioeconomic status, or maybe just their ethnic background in getting into STEM fields, is the ability to have an opportunity to level the playing field. And what I mean by that is there's a high-level talks happening in industries and startups throughout the city of Boston on how to increase diversity by doing diversity outreach campaigns, et cetera. But there's not a lot of talk about how to do that. And what I've noticed in my experience is that companies start to take minority candidates seriously when they actually see that talent is truly universal. And the way they're able to see that is when they start working with those organizations that are on the front line mm-hmm. to those minority populations, whether that's a partnership with the hackathon, whether that's a hands-on workshop like what we do in partnership with some private interests as well as public interests, in which they see the kids come up with amazing ideas to tackle challenges their company or their organization are facing, and realize if these kids just have the opportunity to access their networks or have a portfolio that shows they're worth their snuff or be exposed to where they can actually go, just like I was, then they're able to show these companies, your investment will allow for me to be your future workforce,
right,
or perhaps even a new company.
You know, it's another part of that the pipeline that Zanindra was talking about, just making connections between industry leaders and communities where the talent lies, if those connections aren't already there. I mean, to that point, actually, can you tell us a little bit about the work that you're doing at the Roxbury Innovation Center?
Sure. So over the past year and a half that I've been an entrepreneur in residence yeah. there, I've been able to get a lens on the actual local challenges facing Boston. Bajika operates around the world, but what I've noticed being based in Roxbury is that the kids have a hunger for being able to develop solutions that improve their lives as well as the lives of their community members. The issue that they have is lack of access to knowledge, resources, and skills. What the Fab Lab Roxbury and the Bajika workshops are able to do at the Roxbury Innovation Center is allow those kids to have a safe place to sit down and actually pretend almost like playing dress-up, that they're the engineer or the inventor they've always seen on TV and in magazines, because companies come to them, whether they're a local business like Tropical Food Supermarket or Frugal Bookstore, or someone who's a national organization like NASA, or maybe one of the hottest startups in Boston, like Ministry of Supply, come to them and say, listen, we have a problem we don't want the world to know about, but we want to use your brain and your talent to help us solve this problem. And you'll see the kids within 3 days all of a sudden start using computer-aided design to create models that come out of 3D printers and laser cutters, creating electronic circuits, et cetera. And what I love about the workshops that we do, it lets industry realize their investment is allowing for that student to realize their dreams can come true through that company. Or maybe they start their own company, and the company they start creates an invention that helps that business that made that initial investment. It helps local nonprofits and public schools, because remember, in Roxbury, we're surrounded by Madison Park, the O'Brien, and yeah. Hamilton, and other schools. It allows those schools to not feel the burden of having to come up with that STEM exposure programming on their own, but to have private industry reach them without having to have that extra work.
Exactly. And, you know, given this latest round of numbers in terms of, you know, if we don't do anything different, that it'll take 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years to close these gaps. I mean, I feel like we could light a fire under each other here in this state to get there a little faster. So Nisha McCray, manager of the Fab Lab and the entrepreneur in residence at the Roxbury Innovation Center, also founder of Bajika, thank you so much for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
You too. Thanks for your work. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Massachusetts has set some ambitious goals when it comes to reducing the state's output of greenhouse gases, cutting that output by 25% by the year 2020. And to reach that benchmark, the Baker administration wants to add more clean energy capacity into the mix, including hydropower from Canada. Well, just yesterday, adding that extra hydropower capacity to the New England grid just got one step closer to reality. The U.S. Department of Energy has granted a permit to the Northern Pass, a nearly 200-mile-long proposed power line that would slice through much of New Hampshire. Now, granted, state officials still need to approve the project, but here's Eversource spokesman Martin Murray on the Energy Department's decision.
We are incredibly well poised to deliver what Massachusetts is requiring and what its citizens want, and that's clean hydroelectric energy from Canada that economically will benefit all of New England.
Well, it may be clean, but it's not morally pure, to be honest, because the hydro energy that would flow through the Northern Pass is fraught with a deep history in northern Canada, and it has impacts beyond the environment and our energy needs in New England. It has displaced the Indigenous peoples of Quebec province, to name the least. Now, the podcast Outside In from our friends at New Hampshire Public Radio has dug into the environmental and true human costs of hydropower from Canada. It's the topic of a four-part series titled Powerline, and the second episode is out now. Sam Evans-Brown is the host of Outside In. He joins us now from Concord, New Hampshire. Sam, welcome to Radio Boston.
So happy to be on the show.
So first of all, I want to talk to you about Northern Pass, actually, because I know it's been hugely controversial in New Hampshire. What's the reaction there to the decision to approve the Northern Pass by the Department of Energy?
Well, I'd say that this particular decision is, you know, it's a major milestone for the project, but it's one that really was not unexpected. I think even the opponents, you know, would occasionally suggest that maybe the presidential permit wouldn't be granted, but it was always kind of a half-hearted suggestion. It was always assumed that the real action on this decision would be at the state level, which is, of course, now pending. We're looking at a deadline of February 28th for a final decision at long last for a project that was first announced back in 2011.
Wow. Okay. So, you know, it's interesting that you should mention that, because I was telling my producer, Jamie, today that I remember a couple presidential cycles ago, I was in northern New Hampshire in the White Mountains when Newt Gingrich was running, and he was at an event at some diner in the Whites, and people were asking him, should those power lines be put underground? I mean, I think to this day, you drive up there and you see lots and lots of the Northern Pass bumper stickers, right? I mean, people do not like this project up there.
Well, and it's sort of by dint of any project taking this long, it means that a very vigorous and organized opposition has been able to form and coalesce around the project, and they are incredibly organized. But I will say, you know, the polling data that we have, which is a little sparse, does show that the state is pretty closely divided among the folks who've heard about it. It's pretty 50-50.
50. Oh, interesting. Okay. Maybe it's just I've been talking to a lot of folks who would have had those power lines go right through their yards.
Yeah. And I'd say it's one of these instances where the opposition is so much more activated than the people who are in favor. I mean, you have some unions who would benefit from the project, and they are sort of getting out, and they've got their own signs. But in terms of the fervor on the two sides, it is quite unbalanced. The opposition is much more engaged than the people who are in favor.
I see. Okay. So let's move further north then, as your series Powerline does, because we are talking about the power that's coming from Hydro-Québec. Now, you visited a dam complex that was some 16-hour drive north of Montreal. Do I have that right?
That's right.
I keep forgetting how big Canada is.
There's a lot north of those cities.
Okay. And so you saw some of the turbines there at the hydropower complex, 22 of them in one facility. And let's play a clip here of you and your tour guide at the facility. The tour guide's a person named Eric Hamill.
So if one of these can power a city, then how much does the whole facility, you said it's...
Oh, that way, this is the equivalent of a town of close to 1.6 million people.
I think that's a city. That's a city, right?
That's one, yes. It's a little bigger than our town. You know, in the Red Sun, we're 280 people, so no problem. We have quite enough with this machine.
Quite enough, yes. Yeah. So, Sam, I mean, just give us a quick sense here. How large is Hydro-Québec? How much power does it produce?
So Hydro-Québec has 62 powerhouses. We're talking, you know, several dozen rivers. And the James Bay complex, the one that I was visiting there in that clip, it's a drainage area roughly the size of France. So it's simply enormous. And it provides not just, I mean, it's 98-99% of the electricity in the province. But that really underestimates how important it is to the energy mix up there, because this electricity is so cheap, something like 70% of Quebecers actually heat their homes with electricity. So it's not just the, you know, the lights and your smartphones. It's also a huge portion of the heat load, which here in New England is, you know, a lot of folks are burning oil or propane or natural gas.
Wow. And I understand that Hydro-Québec produces a $2 billion dividend that goes straight into Quebec's coffers every year.
Yeah, in fact, this is so. It's a crown corporation. It's uh-huh. It's the only shareholder of this corporation is the Quebecois government, and so that means that not only does it generate $2 billion or so worth of tax revenue, but there's this additional $2 billion dividend that, if this were a private company, would be going to private shareholders, but instead goes to the government.
Okay, so great for modern day Quebecois. And perhaps, you know, good for New England if Hydro-Québec's power comes down here. But the project goes back to what, the 1950s?
So the first dams were actually, they have dams that are actually more than 100 years old.
Oh, I see. Okay.
That are still kicking. But what Hydro-Québec was born, so the modern iteration of the company was born in the 1960s. And that's really when the dam building boom took off. That's when they started building these mega projects. There's the Manic-Outard mega project and then the James Bay mega project. And you know, you can look at the sort of graph of their capacity, which just skyrockets in those years.
And and that was the time which they came into significant conflict with the native peoples there, right?
Yes, indeed. And their first mega projects, they were able to sort of get them in without notifying any native people and without getting any major pushback. And that was the first place that we visited, a place called Pessimitz, which hosts something like a third of Hydro-Québec's hydro capacity. A lot of these people, you know, they were living this sort of quasi-nomadic lifestyle, and they were paddling upriver one year, and all of a sudden they came around the river bend to find that there was a dam being built on this river that their families had been using for millennia, really. But then the next project, the James Bay project, ran up against the Crees, and the Crees learned that this thing had been announced. There was a lot of fanfare around the James Bay project, and they immediately decided to lawyer up. They filed an injunction. They got work stopped and really kind of changed Canadian history, because this process of having to sit down at the table between, you know, with First Nations and developers at the same table, it became a model for how Canada would negotiate what are now called modern treaties.
Mm. Well, we have more tape here from the podcast to that point. This is Robert Konodawat, chief of the Chisabi Cree, and he spoke to you about some of those negotiations between Hydro-Québec and his people back in the 70s.
What they say, you know, is that we weren't the owners of the land. You know, they kept saying that. And we said that we managed to convince that they are trespassing, you know, that they should pay for taking our land, our resources, our livelihood, and the way we want to live.
Sam, the part of that cut that really stays with me is that the Cree had to convince the Canadian government that they were the owners of the land.
Yes, indeed. And it gets to this really fascinating history of you know, treaty making in Canada, which is that sort of as settlement moved west and as the British conquered the French, this policy of signing treaties so that you had kind of a paper trail to say that, hey, we own the land, was instituted. But that didn't begin until they got to Ottawa and Manitoba. And so the provinces, the eastern provinces, there were never any treaties signed in which the First Nations formally relinquished their land rights, which meant that this was kind of and in many places, it's still an open question as to exactly who owns this land.
Still an open question. Wow. I mean, but as the decades went on, though, had the way that the authorities around Hydro-Québec and their interactions with the First Nations there improved? Have those relations changed significantly?
They have. In fact, and this came from, so the Crees won, signed the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement, which was this landmark first deal. But many of the tenants weren't really being honored, they felt. And so they kicked up another fight in the 80s and 90s against another hydro project called the Great Whale, which many people here in New England in the Northeast might have heard of this fight. This is when the Crees built a boat with the Inuit and they paddled down to New York City and they enlisted, you know, Robert Kennedy Kennedy Jr. into their fight, and they managed to stop that project dead in its tracks, which meant that after this, Hydro-Québec learned that they would have to pivot. And now, whenever they propose a project, they immediately start by reaching out to communities affected, and they have to consult and accommodate is the legal language. They have to talk with the communities who are affected and try to accommodate their concerns before they can build a project.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've just got a couple seconds left here, Sam. I'm curious now, like, bring us to the present day. How much is the fact that Massachusetts wants more hydropower from Hydro-Québec? Are we a small player here or a big one? Could have any effect on what's happening in Canada?
Well, it's actually really fascinating. Over the years that I've been covering energy here in New Hampshire, I've increasingly realized that Massachusetts is the player. Massachusetts is 50% of the load in New England, and Massachusetts energy policy really, in many ways, becomes de facto New England energy policy. So yes, whether this power line gets built or not basically will be up to the Bay State.
Wow. Well, Sam Evans-Brown is the host of the NHPR podcast Outside In, and together with producer Hannah McCarthy, they've got this four-part series, terrific one, called Powerline. The first two episodes are now available. We've got links to them at radioboston.org. Sam, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Meghna.
Well, that's it for today and this week. Thanks so much for spending this time with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.